So there's more than one kind of interaction, Havers said. There's the kind you've already described, where you play big brother to a collection of nippers who look at you and think you're the next King Arthur. And then there's the kind you might prefer no one to see or to know about. And if someone saw those interactions, that could be unpleasant all the way round. I don't even know what you're on about, Finn said. Havers said, here's what it is, Finn. We've got this web of facts and figures and who knew what and who did what and what happened next, and we keep getting led back to the centre of the web where the spider is, and that spider keeps looking exactly like you.
We've also learned that your father asked the PCSO here in town to keep an eye on you, Lindley told him. So it looks as if he, your father, that is, had his own concerns.
No way!
Finn licked his lips. His tongue looked grey. His gaze shifted to Havers, then back to Lindley. He looked like a boy whose bravado had suddenly been stripped from his body.
"Which part, no way?" Havers asked. "Because I expect you can see what it looks like from our perspective."
She gestured aimlessly to her right, saying,
"I also expect you know how easy it is to tiptoe up Weeping Cross Lane, practically outside your front door, this is, and from there to the Nick, with no one the wiser, especially at night. You can saunter right into the car park, you can, and not be caught on CCTV, since it doesn't work. You can even go in the back door of the station. And if Gary Ruddock is doing what he sometimes is doing with his lady friend in a patrol car, Gaz doesn't even have a girlfriend, he whinges about that often enough, then you can pretty much do anything at the police station, including ringing the call centre. I told you! I got no idea about that stupid anonymous whatever it was about Ian, and it wasn't true anyways! Or even locating Mr. Druitt one night last March and giving him the chop, since Mr. Druitt might have seen something he wasn't supposed to see. What? No way! Who spun all this for you? Was it Gaz? Because if it was, he was lying. Or Ian was lying. Or some little kids who got their feelings hurt by me and I don't even know it is lying. But here's what it is. I don't have to talk to you anymore, and I'm not going to. You got that? Because this is all rubbish and I'm not listening to it, and whatever anyone said about me is a filthy lie.
He shoved his chair back with a scrape on the liner that it wouldn't soon recover from, and stamped out of the room. At first it looked as if he intended to do a runner when he opened the front door. But then he shouted,
"You lot get out! I know what you're doing, I'm not playing! Get out!"
When neither of them moved from where they were in the kitchen doorway, he slammed the front door closed so forcefully that the windows shook in the kitchen. He pounded up the stairs and did the same to his bedroom door.
"That's some protest."
Havers started to head for the front door herself when above them a door opened, footsteps padded on the landing, and then a girl's voice said,
"Finn, are they gone?"
Gentle knocking on his door.
"You in there, Finn?
What did they want?"
Havers looked at Lindley. He held up his hand. They waited. Silence, and then the girl herself came down the stairs. She saw them and stopped dead. She wore a thin cotton nightdress that she clutched virginally at her throat. Dina Donaldson. She began to turn to go back up the stairs. Lindley said, "If we could have a word, Dina."
"Why?"
"For the sake of curiosity."
"About what?"
"Rabia Lomax." She remained where she was. She looked at them in turn. She said,
"I haven't done anything. I don't see why I need to talk to you."
"You don't need to. We're merely requesting. You can deny the request."
"Which," Havers added, "would make us wonder why."
"A great many things are centering on this house," Lindley said. "You might be able to clarify at least one of them, and we'd be in your debt." Dina didn't look as if she were anywhere close to being on board with that idea, but she came slowly down the stairs. She was not a tall girl, Lindley noted. She was shapely, however, and quite pretty as well, although at the moment her face was pinched. She joined them and said,
"All right. What do you want me to clarify?"
"Thank you," Lindley said. "You can clarify your relationship to Rabia Lomax."
"Why?"
"Because she appears to be on the periphery of what we're here looking into."
"That's got nothing to do with me."
"Accepted." She said nothing to this. Havers said,
"So if you wouldn't mind. I know Missa, her granddaughter. Mrs. Lomax came over here yesterday because she had a message for me from her, from Missa."
"Odd that it couldn't have been given by phone,"
Havers noted.
"Missa had a necklace off me. She forgot to give it back. Mrs. Lomax brought it."
"Was it a message or the necklace?" Lindley asked.
What? It couldn't have been both?
What was the message? Havers asked.
Dina cocked her head and observed the sergeant. She said,
I don't think I have to tell you that. It was personal, and I don't expect it has anything to do with why you're here. She had a boyfriend, she broke up with him, they're back together, that's all I'm saying.
What about you? Havers said. You have a boyfriend as well?
Not at present.
Not even Gary Ruddock?
Who?
The PCSO.
I saw you with him one night at the police station. In a car, actually. What was that about?
Dina's gaze flitted from Havers to Linley, back to Havers. She said,
I don't even know that bloke. All I know is he comes round the Hart and Hind whenever there's the tiniest complaint about the noise, because everyone round there goes to bed, like at 7:30. But there's no way I would be in a patrol car with him. Okay? So I've answered your questions, and if you don't mind, I'm going back upstairs. I've got a
lecture, right, Havers said. The whole boiling kettle of you are real scholars, aren't you?
They watched the girl go back up the stairs and heard a door shut. The roar of water into the bathtub began a moment later. Havers said to Linley,
Swear to God that was the girl with Ruddock, sir.
Linley said, It's impossible to be certain, Sergeant, that night. The car in the shadows, anyway.
Right. Except for one thing.
He glanced at her. She looked oddly happy. What's that? He asked her.
I never mentioned a patrol car. She's the one who said it was.
He directed his gaze up the stairway again. He nodded thoughtfully. We'll need someone to confirm, he said.
Right. I know who can probably do it. We just need to find him.
Worcester, Herefordshire. Trevor Freeman hadn't the first clue who would be ringing him at such an hour of the morning. It wasn't even 6:30, but then he saw the name of the caller on his mobile screen and his skin jumped uneasily. He pushed away the bed covers, grabbed his phone, said, Finn, you all right? In answer, he heard what sounded like a combination of shouting and sobbing. He could understand nothing. He said, Slow down, I can't understand you. What's happened? Has there been an accident?
For God's sake, Finn, take a breath.
Are you sitting?
No, sit down.
Find a place.
Sit down!
I'm here. Just put yourself in order. He waited. He heard noises, snuffling, shuffling, heavy breathing like a runner's, and then the story. It came from his son in fits and starts, but he got the gist of it easily enough. New Scotland Yard, the same detectives who'd come to Worcester to speak with Clover. Something to do with pots and pans in his bedroom, and then the claim, the accusation, the grilling, the whatever the hell you wanted to call it, and it was easy enough, wasn't it easy, when it did not involve your son? By the end of Finn's fractured recitation of the facts, Trevor felt a claw grab his lungs. He got himself together enough to calm the boy, which was mostly an attempt to reassure him that his father was going to handle this.
Dad, he lied! He lied!
Trevor didn't know if he meant Gaz Ruddock or Ian Druitt. He said, I'll see to it, Finn. You're not to do anything, do you understand?
That whole bit about the kids. I never did what I was meant to do, Dad. I wouldn't. Why would anyone say? And now they think. And they've got it in their heads I went to the police station. I didn't do anything. Not a fucking thing.
Let me handle this, Finn. Will you trust me to do that?
What? What?
Just wait. Don't do anything. I'll be in touch.
I want a fucking...
Right, I know. I'd feel the same. But keep your distance. Trust me. When he rang off, he could feel the claw twisting a path to his bowels. Dimly, he heard the radio below in the kitchen. Morning news was playing. She was still at home. But of course she would be, 25 minutes after the hour. She would not have left for work yet. He started for the bedroom door, realized he was naked, and searched round for his shorts on the floor. As he was doing this, the radio snapped off. Footsteps followed, and then the sound of the front door opening and closing, and he understood she had left the house. He dashed to the window. But her back was to him, and she was inside the car before he had the presence of mind to bang on the glass. Then he grabbed up his shorts, pulling them on, and racing down the stairs. But she was gone before he got the front door open, because ever the security buff, she had double-locked it, and the key wasn't on its hook. She'd hidden it from him. She'd expected this. She'd known it was coming, and she wasn't intending to be there to face the consequences of what she was bringing down upon them all. He ransacked the single drawer in the entry table that served the purpose of holding their day's post till they could get to it. The key wasn't there. Then into the kitchen and shoving things round the worktop. Then at last the table where the key lay in the basket of paper table napkins, and God, he hadn't put it there. He swore it. She had to have done it. He grabbed it and made for the door and ran outside to the street where his car was parked. It was when he tried to insert the key that he saw how badly his hands were shaking. So were his knees, and so were his arms. And what was it that was causing him to quake, like a child alone in the dark? Anger, fear, terror, anxiety, despair. Could one shake from despair? He set off after her. She was a creature of habit. Weren't they all when it came to the routes they took to their jobs? It wasn't a time for a leisurely drive. It was a case of get there the fastest and easiest way, which, in Clover's case, meant the A38. When he reached that road, he switched on his hazard lights. He used the horn. There was one dual carriageway on the route, and when he came upon it, he pulled into the right lane and pressed the pedal to the floor. He'd caught her up within 5 miles as she was driving sensibly. Not at all like him. She pulled over at the first opportunity. It wasn't a lay-by, just a broader-than-normal stretch of verge edged by poplars. There they both got out of their cars, he with his mobile, which he waved at her, she looking puzzled, as well she would, since there he was, shirtless, shoeless, wearing only his shorts, the cool morning air making his bollocks shrink. She said, "I have it in my bag, Trev. That must be yours. You should have just rung me, and you would have known." "It's all gone to hell," he told her. "Whatever the two of you are up to, it's all gone to hell." She blanched at his tone. "What's going on? You're scaring me." "What's going on is our son. He's just phoned me. I've never heard him in the state he's in."
"Is he?
Did he?" "Those two London detectives appeared at his bedside like the ghost of whatever Christmas you want it to be. They woke him out of a sound sleep, dragged him into the kitchen and grilled him."
"My God."
She looked at the phone he was still holding. Then she looked beyond him at the traffic that continued to whiz by, far too close to where they were standing, and she drew him between their two cars.
"What did he say? Where is he? He wasn't arrested, was he?"
When I could understand him between the shrieks and sobs,
"He's at home, isn't he? He hasn't been arrested, has he?
The cops came to talk to him about what he's been up to with the 6-year-olds or 8-year-olds, or however old they are in that fucking after-school club that you bloody insisted he take on as a social duty. Your London coppers,
they are not my coppers,
have apparently concluded that Druitt's concerns about Finn must have had to do with Finn and children. So what I want to know is, did you know this from the first?"
"Know what? That the London police were going to..."
"Bollocks to the London police! Did you know that Druitt's phone calls to Gaz were about Finn's behaviour around the children? Is this what everything's been about between you two?"
"I've tried to explain it to you, Trevor. This is about the Met, start to finish. I know how they think, and I know how they work. The first time round, when they were in Ludlow, I tried to tell Finnegan that he wasn't to speak to them without someone there, but he wouldn't listen, and now here we are. This is exactly what I feared."
"What? That the cops would decide our son's a child molester?"
"Of course not! It was the Metropolitan Police, full stop. I never wanted him to face them alone for any reason, but he wouldn't see the importance of that. He thought he would be a match for them for whatever they had to ask him, because he thought it was all about Ian Druitt and children. And it was about that, and about the IPCC investigation, and I bloody well thought we were through with it all. Yet here they are again, and
he thinks you set them on him, you and Gaz. Now why would he think that, Clover?"
"Stop being ridiculous. Look, you're shivering. Can we at least get into one of the cars if we're going to go at it?"
"Don't do your usual."
"Which is what?"
"Which is trying to position me where you want me to be, which, as we both goddamn know, you're expert at doing." She raised her hands as if she wanted to make them into fists, or pull her hair out, or seek guidance from the heavens. She said,
"Trevor, why would I set the Met on our son? I've spent his life trying to protect him from himself, so why at this goddamn 11th hour would I decide the effort's just too much trouble and have at him, London, because I give up?"
"Because that makes one hell of an excellent smokescreen," he said, "especially if you know there isn't a shred of evidence against him, so it won't matter what happens to him in the short term, since you're looking at the long run." She took this in with a slow inhalation. She was, he knew, either garnering inner reserves of calm, or merely trying to look like someone garnering inner reserves of calm. She said,
"You say directly what you're implying.
There are things you don't want anyone knowing, including me. And this is one hell of a good way to accomplish that."
"Things? What things?"
"You tell me, Clover. I'm sick and tired of being played for a fool."
"That's what you think?"
"That's what I think." She stepped towards him. She spoke directly into his face.
"You listen to me," she hissed. "I didn't want him at West Mercia College, but I agreed to it. I didn't want him in accommodation, but I agreed to it.
Yes, I'd had doubts that he can ever manage his life on his own, but I went along with what he wanted and what you wanted, and now just look where we are. God knows what he's said to those Met detectives. God knows what they think. I would like you, just for once, Trevor, to see that what's going on just now has nothing to do with my relationship with our son or my relationship with anyone on the planet. If you want to stand there and accuse me of interfering in Finnegan's life, you might also want to take a look at your own bloody focus on every interaction he and I have ever had. And that probably includes how I changed his nappies. We've been at loggerheads over him since the day he was born, and I suggest you look at that. I also suggest you look at where we are now because of it. Now I'm going to work to see what can be done about all of this, because you and I can at least agree on one bloody thing regarding Finnegan's life.
Which is what? He demanded.
Which is that there isn't a shred of evidence that Finnegan did anything to anyone at any time. That's what needs to be dealt with first. As to the rest of it, she gestured between the two of them, we shall have to deal with that later.
She turned then and strode back to her car. She'd left it running, so it was a simple matter for her to drive off and leave him standing there, unsure which of them had scored how many points. Ludlow, Shropshire. Barbara Havers had expected to engage in something of a search through the centre of town to find Harry Rochester. She was surprised, therefore, to see him crossing the Ludford Bridge as she and Linley were heading in the direction of Broad Street's climb up to the medieval heart of the town. She pointed him out to Linley, who pulled over to the curb, saying, "You take this, Sergeant. I don't think it needs both of us." When she climbed out of the car and called out to the dosser, he gave her a jaunty wave with his flute. He called back,
"This is early hours for you, isn't it, Barbara?"
"You too," she said. "Can I have a word?"
"Certainly."
They met at the foot of the bridge on the Ludlow side. Barbara greeted Sweet Pea, who was, as always, obediently at Harry Rochester's thigh. The Alsatian's tail wagged when Barbara said her name, but she waited at her master's side to be greeted.
"Are you already so early at work?" Harry said to Barbara.
"I'm generally engaged with a pillow in a meaningful way at this hour, but we had something needed doing early. Where are you coming from? You and Sweet Pea having an early morning stroll?"
"Yes and no," he said. "We spent the night above the river."
"Get tossed from the centre of town?"
"No, no. When the weather improves, Pea and I sometimes like a bit of nature on the occasional evening. There's something of an open area along the Bread Walk with quite a nice view of the castle, and it has the added benefit of being off the path far enough that I can leave my belongings there, such as they are, and go about my day unburdened. Or I can pick them up in the evening and choose a spot lower down on the bank. On this side of the river, of course, as there's too much of a bluff on the other."
He vaguely indicated an area beyond the Charlton Arms.
"Are you familiar with the Bread Walk?"
he said, settling in for a natter. "People from town take exercise there, strolling, biking, running, walking their dogs. It's a very good route between the bottom of Dinham Street and here."
"A shortcut?"
"Yes.
And what I find fascinating is its history. It's called the Bread Walk because the workers who used it in ages past were paid not in coin but in bread. This was to keep them from drinking down their wages on their way home and arriving there with no food for their families. Not a bad idea when you consider man's weakness for the drink.
But a bit annoying if one has a plan to put something away for one's golden years, eh?"
"Well, yes, there is that little problem, isn't there? Although I'm not certain anyone actually lived long enough to have golden years in those days. Would you like to accompany us, Sergeant? P and I were heading up to Castle Square.
With something to flog?"
"Alas, not today. We're interested in the stalls, as it's a food market morning, and we're feeling peckish. And, which is particularly interesting to P here, the sausage caravan will be present. It's early for them to be selling yet, but we'd like to pay a very quick visit to the spa to pick up a few supplies of a personal grooming nature being held for me at the till. I wouldn't say no to finding a copy of The Guardian as well, although the news is always a day old and bad anyway, so one does occasionally ask oneself what the point is. But one feels the need now and then, and today I feel the need."
"Premonition?"
"I hope not, as my premonitions are generally disaster-laden. Earthquakes, tsunamis, hurricanes, tornadoes, entire towns falling into the sea, that sort of thing. Are you with the inspector?"
"He's back in the car."
She gestured in the direction from which she'd walked to meet Harry at the bridge.
"What a ride up to the square, then?"
"I couldn't possibly cope with being inside a car. I can barely manage 30 seconds inside the spa to pay for my purchases. Can I help you in some way, Barbara?
I ask because while I'm quite pleased with the early morning greeting, when it comes from a member of the police force, one tends to think there might be a secondary agenda.
Wise way to look at things. It's to do with the PCSO, actually.
Barbara reminded Harry of what he'd told her, seeing Gary Ruddock with various young people, squiring them home or to the police station or to wherever it was he took them when they were causing aggro late at night in the town. Did Harry remember telling her that? Indeed he did, he told her. She asked him if he thought he would recognise any of them if he saw them again, but not in the company of the PCSO. To that he told her that he wasn't at all sure. When he'd seen Mr. Ruddock with young people, it was often at night. It was generally quite late, or if not late, it was usually dark. Unless they passed under a street lamp, he wouldn't have got a good look at them. So he couldn't swear with any degree of certainty about anything. Plus, there was the difficulty of seeing young people all round the town anyway, and especially in the vicinity of Castle Square, with its access to West Mercia College. Thus it would be difficult for him, seeing a young person after the fact, to say that he or she was also someone he'd seen previously in the company of Gary Ruddock. Did the sergeant understand what he meant? She did, naturally, but
would you be willing to have a go anyway?
Certainly. Should I ring you if I happened to see a familiar face?
Barbara told him that no, she had something different in mind. Now that the weather was improving, although England being England, it would probably all go to hell with the advent of June, would he be willing to meet her and the inspector at the Hart and Hind this evening? He would indeed be willing, he told her, as long as he could meet her and the inspector outside, even in the event of a cloudburst, and as long as he could also remain in the company of Sweet Pea. Barbara agreed to this. So they set a time and said their farewells. Barbara returned to Linley. He'd got out of the car, she saw, and was contemplating the weir. A female mallard and her ducklings were tranquilly paddling there. Linley said, "He's out and about early, isn't he?
Says he likes a change of scenery when the weather allows it."
Linley nodded, but looked thoughtful. After a moment he said, "That's quite good to know, isn't it? It makes him available for all sorts of things. To act, to be acted upon, to be a witness to action."
"That's what I thought, sir."
She told Linley about the plan she'd laid with Harry Rochester, the Hart and Hind that evening, fingers crossed about who might turn up. She was just concluding when her mobile phone rang. She had to do a bit of excavating, but she found it before it went to message. It turned out to be Flora Bevans, yet another early riser. She said she'd had a thought, one she'd tossed round in her head to decide if it had any value at all.
"I certainly don't want to muddy the waters," she said, "but I've recalled something having to do with Ian that I failed to tell you earlier."
Barbara gave a thumbs up to Linley. She said,
"Any information is helpful,"
and waited for what that information was.
"It has to do with my sister, actually," Flora Bevan said. "As you're in town, at least I assume you're in town, standing right by the Ladford Bridge, admiring the waterfowl." "Oh, yes. It's quite lovely, isn't it, that bridge, with those wonderful spars for pedestrians? I'm quite fond of it." "And your sister?"
Flora didn't assume Barbara was inquiring about her sister's affection or lack thereof for the bridge. She said,
"This was several months ago. Greta rang me and asked if Ian might be willing to speak to one of the students at the college. I can't remember whether it was a male or female student. I'm not sure I ever knew in the first place, frankly. But what I do remember is that Greta asked me if I'd pass along a message to Ian to phone her so that she could explain, as it seemed rather an urgent matter." "Is she connected to the college in some way?" Barbara asked. "Oh, sorry, I've left that part out, haven't I? She's a counsellor at West Mercia College. The only one there is, actually." "So this was about, what, something she couldn't handle herself? Beyond her expertise or whatever?"
"I expect it was more to do with her workload. She's fully qualified for the job she does, but getting to things is the issue, since there is one of her, and I actually have no idea how many students there are, but it's got to be hundreds, hasn't it? On the other hand, if the student was in some kind of spiritual crisis, Ian would have been better as a counsellor, since Greta gave up religion as an adolescent. At any rate, I thought you ought to know about it, as it had to do with Ian. Shall I give you her number? I'm sure she'll be happy to talk to you."
Barbara told her that yes, indeed, Greta's number would be appreciated, and if anything else popped into Flora Bevans's mind, she wasn't to hesitate day or night.
"I hope you find it marginally helpful," Flora Bevans said.
"Everything is," Barbara assured her.
She rang off and related the information to Linley. He agreed it wanted looking into. "After breakfast?" he suggested. She was happy to hear this.
"You know me, sir. Last thing I'd ever say no to is a meal."
St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. When she'd volunteered for the duty, Rabia Lomax hadn't given the slightest thought to the fact that chairing the Maintenance and Repairs Committee of Volare Cantare might be quite a time-devourer. Why would it be? The beauty of a glider was the fact that, in comparison to a motorized plane, there was very little to maintain or repair. But her taking up the position of chair was soon followed by one of the club members forgetting to engage the undercarriage prior to landing, and who would pay for the subsequent damage to the plane was the hottest topic they'd come upon in years. Obviously, one group asserted, the pilot ought to pay. Unfair, another group declared, as their dues were supposed to cover something, besides drinks and nibbles at their monthly meetings in Church Stretton, weren't they? And by the way, what about their insurance? A fortuitous occurrence, announced the third, since really, shouldn't they start thinking of purchasing an entirely new glider anyway? Every year more bells and whistles were added to gliders in the form of safety features and technical components. Theirs was a virtual antique, and this was a moment they could seize, making use of it to benefit everyone. Thus the Maintenance and Repairs Committee were tasked with making a recommendation, and the club members were tasked with agreeing to it. Thus each proponent of a solution to the problem had sent a representative to be part of the meeting on this particular morning. Rabia was only too glad she'd insisted on a relatively early start, because it looked as if Dennis Crook and Nio Marsh Stewart, whose mother had obviously had a thing for Roderick Allen, would prefer to resort to fisticuffs in the street rather than compromise. They just reached the point of Nio's, "See here, my good man," always an indication that more was to come, and it wasn't likely that the more would be pleasant, when the doorbell sounded. Rabia excused herself, rather thankful to have an escape from the rising tension, although when she saw who'd come calling upon her, she was equally thankful to have an excuse not to let them into the house.
"I'm quite sorry," she said, "but I've got something on at the moment."
Detective Inspector Linley, she reminded herself, was the man. The woman was Sergeant Havers.
"It's a committee meeting, and I'm the chair."
"We're happy to wait," Linley replied.
"Love to listen in as well," Havers added.
"Unfortunately, there's not enough seating, and the topic is nothing that will please, I guarantee you, an argument over the purchase or repair of a glider."
"Sounds exciting to me," Havers said. "What about you, sir?"
"Indeed," from Linley. "But if there's no room for us,
I'll ring you when we've finished.
We can easily wait in the kitchen, or your garden, or we can speak here on the pavement if you'd like to step outside."
"We've had a word with Greta Yates at West Mercia College, Mrs. Lomax," Havers said, in a tone far less friendly than that which was carried on her earlier words. "Turns out that in a roundabout fashion, she put Ian Druitt, the deacon, I reckon you remember him, into contact with a girl called Melissa, surname Lomax. To me and the inspector here, we were thinking that what we have is one of two things. Either one hell of a coincidence with two Lomaxes being counselled by a bloke who turns up dead in the local nick, or one Lomax being counselled by the bloke while the other Lomax tells tales to the coppers who are trying to work out what the hell happened to him."
Linley said, "Do you care to shed light on this, Mrs. Lomax?" "Miss Yates was good enough to give us Melissa Lomax's details."
"That means we can track her down,"
the sergeant added politely. "But we thought you might wish to illuminate the matter."
"You don't need to, of course," the sergeant went on, "but things keep getting curiouser and curiouser, if you know what I mean, since Dina Donaldson also has a connection to your granddaughter, and we're wondering what that's all about when it's tucked up in bed. Turns out that Melissa's mobile number matches one that Mr. Druitt phoned on two occasions, by the way. I've rung it myself, but all I get is one of those automated messages. The owner of the phone, that will be Melissa, I reckon, hasn't returned my call."
Rabia had felt the sweat on the backs of her knees the moment Greta Yates's name had been spoken. She was determined, however, not to be cowed. She needed to buy herself some time, though, and she tried to use the committee meeting once again to do so. It was a complicated matter they were dealing with. It was going to take more time than they wanted to wait about, surely. She would ring them. "As I said, we're quite happy to wait. You might want to ring your solicitor as well,
since spinning towels for the Rosses is never quite the idea," Havers added.
Rabia saw no other choice. She said,
"If you'll wait in the kitchen, and I'd be grateful if you didn't introduce yourself to anyone as the police."
"I'm fine with that," Havers said. "What about you, sir? Good at posing as a roofer, are you? Or a plumber, since we'll be in the kitchen?"
"If only I'd thought to bring my spanner." Rabia hustled them into the house. She rejoined the subcommittee meeting, where it had been decided in her absence that the only solution was going to be bringing the matter to the entire club for a vote. The committee could recommend nothing, it seemed. The three factions could reach no compromise. By the time she'd shut the door on the last of them, Rabia had made her decision about what she wanted to say. She went into the kitchen, astonished when the man actually stood politely, something she hadn't seen from a male in years, and she began before they could pose a question.
"When you first came to speak with me, my main concern was the protection of my granddaughter. The lives of her entire family, of my entire family, have undergone an upheaval. Missa's younger sister died over a year ago after a long illness. Missa wanted to leave West Mercia College and return home to be a support to her youngest sister. Sati, her youngest sister, wanted it, but no one else thought it was a good idea. Missa first brought it up over the Christmas holiday, but was talked into returning to the college. It was clear she wasn't happy about it, but none of us knew she was seeing Mr. Druitt for support, and I certainly didn't know when you lot first came calling. I wanted to speak with Missa before I turned her over to you. I'm sure you would have done the same had you found yourself in a similar position."
"Perhaps she was seeing the deacon for another reason," Lindley said.
"She's not a liar," Rabia said. "Things have been difficult for everyone since Jana's death, and things were terrible enough leading up to it. She had very good reason to want to speak with someone."
"Except, since Greta Yates turned her name over to Ian Druitt, it's not like your granddaughter sought him out herself," Havers noted.
"Regardless of how she got there, what can Mrs. seeing him possibly have to do with his death?"
"We have no answer for that," Lindley told her.
"But we're working at it," Havers added. "See, it's turning out that everyone's connected to everyone else. We speak to you about Ian Druitt. We see you speaking to Dina Donaldson. Dina Donaldson lives in the same house as Finnegan Freeman. Finnegan Freeman assisted Ian Druitt with his after-school club. Ian Druitt had meetings with your granddaughter. Your granddaughter is a close friend of Dina Donaldson."
"The number of connections is rather remarkable," Lindley said.
"I can explain where I fit easily enough,"
Rabia countered. Now her armpits were dampening as well.
"There was a misunderstanding I was clarifying with Dina. I'd assumed that she was using our name because she was meeting with Ian Druitt."
"Why did you assume that?"
Havers asked. "It seemed logical, as she and Missa were close friends."
Lindley was watching her, his expression frankly appraising. Rabia noticed his eyes, which were brown. Odd in a blonde, she thought. There was a tight little silence among them. In it, a car drove by, that irritating rap music pounding from its open window. Lindley finally said, "Might we return to the possibility of your granddaughter seeing the deacon for an altogether different reason from the one she's given you?" "Good Lord," Rabia thought. The man spoke courteously. Her defences immediately rose. She said,
"We're not a spiritual family, if that's what you mean. I can't imagine Missa meeting with him to discuss Jesus, the Trinity, afterlife, or any other topic associated with religion."
There were condoms in Mr. Druitt's car, an open box with a number of them missing.
"You're suggesting a sexual relationship between Missa and the man? No, it's unthinkable. Missa has a long-time boyfriend in Ironbridge, and even if that were not the case, she's put great store in being a virgin when she marries. Old-fashioned, I know, but there you have it."
"Sometimes girls do that," Havers said. "I mean, sometimes they say they intend to stay pure or whatever, until they don't, if you know what I mean."
"That she found the deacon compelling and decided to sleep with him? That's hardly in character."
Lindley said, "We're going to have to speak with her. You do see that, I hope." Rabia did see it, only too well. But speaking to Missa was the last thing she wanted, because the waters of her family were troubled enough already. She said,
"Please don't. She has nothing to tell you. This poor man who died, it's nothing to do with her. How can I get you to see that?"
And of course, she knew the answer to her question, even as she voiced it.
Ludlow, Shropshire. Yasmina Lomax believed that the real source of her daughter's troubles sprang from the death of her younger sister. From being witness not only to Jana's death, but also to the potential dissolution of her parents' marriage as a result of that death, had sprung Missa's determination to alter her own life. But she'd chosen a way to do this that was going to be self-defeating. It was because of this that Yasmina had attempted to speak with Missa that morning. It was because of this that she cancelled her appointments at the clinic and made the journey to Ludlow. With Missa, Yasmina had got nowhere. She had risen early, grateful for once that Timothy had drugged himself into a state from which his alarm failed to awaken him, and she'd gone to her daughter's bedroom. She'd opened the door softly and paused there, taking in Missa's sleeping form, and then the room itself. She wondered why she'd failed to find it odd that the room was unchanged from Missa's childhood. Beloved children's books, tucked into their shelves, dolls in their respective positions on top of a chest beneath the window. a stuffed bear long ago given the silly name Ishibishi, for reasons no one remembered, the jewellery box atop the chest of drawers, which, when opened, displayed a plastic ballerina dancing on a mirror to Lara's theme, that musical paean to doomed love, always sending out the message that giving into passion would lead to disaster. Yasmina opened the jewellery box, the tinny music played, and from behind her she heard Missa stir in her bed and say, "Mum, what time is it?" Yasmina closed the box, turned, and answered with, "We must speak, you and I. Will you come to the kitchen and have some tea, or shall we speak here?" Missa flipped onto her back. For a moment she looked only at the ceiling, and Yasmina wondered if it would be the girl's intention not to speak at all. But then she sat up, took a sip from the glass of water on her bedside table, and said, "Here, then." Yasmina drew the chair from the knee-hole of Missa's desk and carried it to the bedside. She said, "Your grandmother told me about the London police coming to question her. She also told me about the conversation you and she had." She fancied seeing a hardness coming into Missa's expression. She went on, "One doesn't generally need to speak to a churchman about leaving college, Missa, so I want you to tell me what's really going on." Missa looked away from Yasmina towards the window, as if wishing she could join the chattering birds outside. She remained wordless. Yasmina said, "I don't understand why you've come to think you can't talk to me. Something has happened. I can see that. Something besides wanting to leave college took you to see that man. But why don't you tell me what you think has happened?" Missa cut in sharply. "Because what I can see from this side of things is that you refuse to accept that I'm not like you. I want something different in my life to what you've had, and you can't cope with that." Yasmina felt slapped by the reply. "That isn't true. No? Just look at the fact that you can't leave this alone. Here you are wanting to talk about it," she made air quotes round the final three words, "when I tried to tell you ages ago that what I want for myself isn't what you want for me, and it's never going to be what you want for me. Tell me now, then. What is it that you want? Why should I tell you again? Have you actually forgotten? Right, then. Let's do this one more time. What I want is to be someone's wife, to be a mum, to have a simple life supporting the man I love and the children we have together. And since you can't entertain that idea in your head for one second, something has to be wrong with me. What's wrong with me, Mum, is that I needed the courage to be who I am and not who you want me to be. That's why I talked to Mr. Druitt, all right? To build up your courage to speak to your own mother. You met with this man not once, not twice, but seven times to build up this courage. Yes, and look how you're reacting. You're searching for some deep reason that I wanted to leave college when there is no deeper reason than the one that I gave you. Or at least that I tried to give you back in December when you wouldn't listen. I did listen. You heard. You didn't listen. Because all you said was that it was too soon. I needed to go back. I had to at least finish college, even if uni wasn't for me. Don't you remember that? And I went back, didn't I? That's what I did, because that's what I always do. No matter how I might feel about something, that's what I do, what you want. Well, that's what I always did. So I talked to him, the deacon, seven times, because I have no one here to talk to, and no one who'll listen without jumping in and trying to make me into someone I'm not. And who is that? I've said! I've just now said, and even that's not good enough. You're not listening because you never listen when you've set something up in your mind. I am listening now. I'm trying to learn. I want to know how I failed to such a degree that you had to seek out this deacon. Did you seek him out? What difference does it make? No, I didn't. He found me, and I'm grateful he did, because he helped me understand things. He helped me see what was right for me to do, and I've done it. And now I want to be left alone. All right? Leave me alone. With that, she'd drawn the bed covers up round her neck and turned her back, and Yasmina had given her the peace she wanted. But things were not over between them, and it was the belief that there was more here than met the eye that took Yasmina from Ironbridge into Ludlow, where she drove to Broad Street, found an available parking spot, and walked the remaining distance to Castle Square. She wound through the market stalls and went beneath the arch on the square's northwest side. Upon it the words, "West Mercia College," glittered in the sunlight of a beautiful spring day. She discovered that the college counsellor, Greta Yates, was not in her office, as she'd left to attend a meeting. She was welcome to wait, she was told, but there was no guarantee that Miss Yates would have time to see her, as her diary was generally filled. Yasmina decided she would take her chances. The matter was critical, she explained. 40 minutes passed before the arrival of Greta Yates occurred. When she first came through the door, Yasmina found herself slipping into physician mode.
bearing witness to what was in the process of killing the other woman. High blood pressure, weight, and type 2 diabetes. She was breathing heavily. Her face was suffused with blood, and a sheen of perspiration spread across her brow. Once Yasmina managed to get into Greta Yates's office, which did not take as long as she'd been led to believe, she added the woman's workload to the list. The state of the office suggested a burglary had recently occurred, one that required the criminals to dump everything from the room to the top of her desk and onto the floor surrounding it, filing folders, computer printouts, brochures, university pamphlets, books, and more. From her desk, Greta Yates brought forth a box of tissues. She took one, blotted her face with it, and then said to Yasmina,
"These are unusual circumstances. This is the second time today that someone's been to see me about your daughter, Mrs. Lomax."
Yasmina didn't make the correction from Mrs. to Doctor, as she would have under other conditions. The fact that someone else had been there to talk to the student counsellor about Missa was far more important.
"Someone else?" she said. "Two officers from New Scotland Yard."
Yasmina tried to get her head round this, as it meant either Rabia had changed her mind and revealed to the police that there was a connection between Missa and Mr. Druitt, or the police had some other reason for speaking to Greta Yates about her daughter. She tried to appear more confused than anxiety-ridden about what was going on. She said,
"I hope you don't mind telling me what their concern was. Missa's not in trouble with the police, is she?"
Greta Yates waved a plump and negating hand, one finger of which was dressed with an impressively large green stone.
"Good heavens, no. They came to see me because I'd asked my sister if she would give a message to Mr. Druitt."
This was hardly making sense.
"A message about Missa?" "About meeting with Missa. You see," she gestured round her office at the piles of material everywhere, "Melissa's tutor requested that I speak with her because she'd begun doing poorly in her studies. She'd done quite well during autumn term, but then she began to... the best expression would be slack off. Her tutor had had a private meeting with her, and he wished me to do the same because she told him she wanted to leave the college, and he had the impression something was wrong. Considering her age, he reckoned it was boy trouble, and she might want to talk it out with me."
"Did she tell him that?"
"She told him only that she wanted to leave college. But it was strange to him, because, as I said, she'd done quite well autumn term."
"What did she say to you?"
"Well, that's just it. Her tutor had counselling sessions in mind. Sessions, in the plural. And in a perfect world, I could actually get round to counselling, as that's what I trained to do. But in this world, I can do little more than work through piles and piles of rubbish like this. Please don't quote me on that. In an attempt to keep my head above water."
Again, she indicated the papers and files.
"However," she added as Yasmina was about to speak, "I knew that my sister had a lodger who was a clergyman. She'd told me he had a degree in social work, so I asked her if he might be willing to have a go. He rang me, and I gave him Missa's details. According to the police this morning, she did have a number of meetings with him." "She's left college anyway. She won't speak of it other than to say that university is not for her, so there's little point in her attendance here. But I don't believe her."
Greta did not look unsympathetic.
"I understand your concern. Most parents would feel as you do. But what I've learned from years of working with young people is that there's a point when parental intervention is more a hindrance than a help."
"He's dead, you know."
"The clergyman. That has something to do with why the London police are here, evidently. Flora, my sister, did tell me he'd died. She said it was suicide."
Greta was silent for a moment, looking across the room at a cluttered bulletin board, but not seeming to see it. She said,
"You aren't thinking your daughter had anything to do with that, are you?"
"I don't know what to think. She won't clarify anything. I speak to her. She shutters her face. She's a different person. I don't know why."
Anxiety was rising within her. Yasmina could feel it shimmering behind her eyes. Missa, college, a dead clergyman, the future, the past, Jana's death, Timothy's drug use. Everything was swarming in her head, and she had to make someone see that a crucial moment had been reached, and this crucial moment had to be explored, or cracked open, or smashed to bits, or reversed, or something, because she didn't know what to do any longer, and she needed someone to step in and take charge. Greta said, as if in answer to her roiling mind,
"This has to be dealt with, obviously. Can you bring Missa here to Ludlow?"
"She'll refuse. She and I, at the moment..."
"Of course. Is there someone else who might get her here?"
Yasmina thought about this. There was someone, but he would have to be convinced to act against his own interests. Greta went on,
If you can get her to me, I'll meet with her happily. Something may well have put her off college, and I believe I can get to the bottom of it. When I do, I'd like to offer her a return so that she can finish up the work from this term and then go on fresh next autumn." She leaned forward and clasped her hands in what seemed to be a gesture of sincerity. She added, "But please do understand, Mrs. Lomax, often all it takes is a period of time for young people to develop a bit more maturity, so that they can see more clearly where they're heading and what the result is going to be if they continue to head there. Would I be correct if I said that it's been quite difficult for you to give her this period of time?"
"You would be, yes," Yasmina replied. "Then your course seems clear, doesn't it? Find a person who can convince her to see me. Let that person do it, and then, as difficult as it is, be patient. We will sort this out."
Worcester, Herefordshire. For the first time, and only the devil knew how long, Trevor Freeman not only needed a workout, but he also wanted one. He reckoned if he drove himself hard enough, he would be able to banish from his head the phone call he'd received from his son, the subsequent conversation he'd had with his wife, and the choices he now faced. When he arrived at Freeman Athletics, he went straight to the treadmill. From there he went to the free weights. From there he went to the stationary gym. From there he went back to the treadmill. His sweat dripped onto the floor round him, and one of the trainers set aside working with a client and came over to him for a word. "Back off before you give yourself a heart attack," was what she said. What he thought was that a heart attack, the emergency services and a stay in hospital might not be a bad idea. Then the police arrived. He was surprised to see them, as he couldn't understand how they had managed to track him down, unless they'd gone to the house, found him not at home, and spoken to one of the neighbours. Also, he wondered why hadn't they just phoned him? Why trek all the way to Worcester? But he answered his own questions once he saw their faces and the manner in which each of them made a study of him. Of course, they wouldn't want to have a phone conversation. They would want to scrutinise his every twitch as he answered their questions. When they asked to talk to him privately, he led the way to his office. He knew he was reeking, so he shut the door on the three of them. If they wanted to question him, they could also damn well breathe in the stench of his dripping body. He said to the male officer, "I've had a phone call from my son. You talk to him again without my being there, and you'll be dealt with by your superiors. What do you lot call it anyway, bursting into a boy's bedroom when he's sleeping and scaring the hell out of him?" "He's been difficult to find at home," the man said. Linley, Trevor thought. His name was Linley. The woman, a sergeant, he remembered, added, "We did knock and ring the bell. You might advise him to lock up at night. God knows who'll end up in bed with him if he doesn't secure the premises." Linley said, "I conclude he was disturbed by our call upon him." "If that's what you want to name it, your call upon him. And how the hell do you expect him to feel?" "He rang you and not his mum," the sergeant said. "Odd that, since she's a copper. Odd, too, that he didn't ring the PCSO, since he lives in the area." "Your finding things odd is your concern, not mine." "It's just that we've been wondering, me and the inspector here, how the PCSO fits into the lives of the Freeman family. He's a decent lad. My wife took an interest, which is actually part of her job, and I don't see what this has to do with the two of you entering my son's bedroom at dawn." "Don't think I called a PCSO a lad. What about you, sir?" she asked Lindley.
"He's rather old for that," Linley agreed.
"What the hell difference does it make how old he is?" Trevor demanded. He couldn't work out what they wanted from him, nor could he see how they'd got him on the defensive so quickly, when being on the defensive was exactly where he'd intended them to be. He said, "The training centre for support officers is on the grounds of police headquarters, where my wife works. Finn and I met Gaz Raddock through her."
"Bring him home, did she?" Havers asked.
"My wife wanted our son to meet him. She thought he'd be a good influence. Like a big brother, as Finn has no siblings. Things went from there."
"Where?" Havers asked.
"What?"
"Where did things go from there?"
"You already know the answer to that. Aren't you wasting your time at this point?" Linley spoke. "If you wouldn't mind humouring us."
"Since we like to keep our facts from getting all knotted up," the sergeant added.
"The PCSO," Linley went on, "told us, as you undoubtedly know, that the two of you developed a plan for him to keep an eye on your son in Ludlow." "Clover's idea," Trevor said. "She didn't want to ask Gaz herself. She thought he might feel pressured to do it if she was the one making the request, because of their relative positions."
"Which positions would those be, exactly?"
from the sergeant. Trevor was glad that his face was undoubtedly flushed from the workout because he could feel his reaction to the double entendre rising tide-like beneath his skin. The obvious one. She outranks Gaz by quite some distance. She didn't want him to think he was required to do her any favours, so she brought it up with me. I thought it was a good idea, so I did the asking. So there it was, he thought. He'd done it. White, black, or any other colour, he'd lied as he'd been requested to lie. He didn't like to think what this suggested about him or his relationship with his wife. Why? Lindley asked. I just told you, Havers said. He doesn't mean, why were you the one to ask? He means, why did you and your wife believe he needed watching over in the first place? You must have been worried about something. I'd call it cautious, not worried. Finn's always been a handful, and his mum's gut told her that he might not do well in Ludlow with unrestricted freedom, as he's never had that. She's trying to structure how he uses his free time. At his age, Lindley said, I expect that would rather chafe. What would?
What the inspector means, Havers clarified once again, is that most boys Finn's age wouldn't much like their mums either organising their time or assigning someone to play their shadow.
Gaz doesn't do that. He just keeps an eye out. Is that what Ian Druitt was meant to do as well? Lindley asked. Trevor didn't like the way they manoeuvred him from point to point. He felt batted between them like a shuttlecock. He took control back, saying, That rubbish you said to Finn this morning? About Druitt having concerns about him or whatever it was? Wherever the hell you got that idea is complete bollocks. Which part of it? Mr. Druitt having concerns about your son, or Mr. Druitt expressing those concerns?
Either one. Both. Finn's a good lad. No one will tell you any different. Yet evidently Mr. Druitt wanted to tell you different, Havers said. We got told he was trying to get in touch with you, asking how to do that.
He didn't get in touch, so whatever he wanted to speak about, and I assume you mean these concerns he was meant to have, must have been taken care of. He was reassured or whatever. Lindley nodded thoughtfully. It's the whatever that we're trying to deal with, Mr. Freeman. Meaning what exactly? Meaning that Mr. Druitt was dead before he could speak to you, Lindley said. Sergeant Havers added, And that's one of those things that the coppers like to look into, bollocks or not.
Much Wenlock, Shropshire. Cardew Hall wouldn't be open daily to visitors until the 1st of June, so Ding knew her arrival there was going to be unexpected, which was exactly what she wanted it to be. Unexpected, and, if she could manage it, unacknowledged and unknown. She wasn't entirely clear in her head why all of this needed to be the case. She just felt it in her body, which was drifting between tense and downright ill. There was, naturally, more than one reason for this. The hall and its surrounds had always been some sort of vortex for her because it was in this location and farther along the road in Much Wenlock that she'd begun her journey of fucking boys the very moment she could manage it. She'd told herself for a long time that she did it for a lark, that she did it for the stories she could tell her mates later, that she did it because she felt the urge. But the truth was she did it for none of those reasons. The larger truth was that she didn't know why she did it except that it felt like violently spitting into some bloke's face. And that was something she wanted to do all the time. And why she wanted to spit and more, to claw, to bite, to punch, the very moment some bloke took possession of her body. This was something she had to learn, because, if nothing else, the experiment in fucking that she had been engaged in for years needed to reach a conclusion. So when she'd attended her two lectures for the day, keeping her promise to Greta Yates, she took the bus that would eventually deposit her in the vicinity of Cardew Hall. She reckoned her mum would be in the vast old kitchen making batch upon batch of the Cardew Hall jams and chutneys that were offered to tourists to purchase after their visits to the hall. Her stepfather would be busy as well, checking the public rooms for burnt-out light bulbs, for sluts' wool missed by the weekly cleaners, and for furniture wanting polishing. If she was careful not to be seen or heard, she could have the place more or less to herself, time alone to investigate, cogitate, and meditate. From where the bus stopped, it took her 20 minutes to trudge to the grounds of the hall. There she saw nearly everything was in bloom, so that the gardens and their beds were awash in colour, from the yellow primroses that edged the herbaceous borders to the purple iris that formed a casual backdrop and softened the effect of the stone boundary walls.
From the drive she could also see the slate roof of St. James's Church, the parish church, but also the Lord of the Manor church. It was where Ding's ancestors, with their piles of money, had nodded regally to their retainers, poor sods, as they serenely floated down the aisle to their special pew. That pew still had the family name upon it. Not Donaldson, of course, since the family name in question was her mother's, and not her dad's. That thought stopped her. Her dad. Not the surname, but the fact of him. Another thought seemed to accompany Dad, resting just on the edge of her consciousness. She hesitated, her gaze on the church's tower, and tried to trick that thought out of her memory. But what came was only a feeling of hollowness, and, along with it, a kind of quivering just beneath her skin that suggested fear? Yes, it was fear. She needed to get out of the sight of that church, she decided, although when she did so by walking round the ancient building that was her home, she really felt no different. She went to the back, to the cellar door, which was accessed by stone steps so old that they bore the indentations of hundreds of years of other people's feet upon them. Once inside, she was in a stone-floored corridor, dimly lit by weak overhead bulbs that hung from flexes. The prominent features of the place were the damp, cobwebs, and dust so thick that the beams in the walls looked grey, rather than what they would be if one ran a finger along them. Black, from having been fashioned from English oaks and taken from various parts of ancient ships. This corridor led to the vast underbelly of Cardew Hall, to its working innards. These consisted of places the public never saw: the kitchen, the larder, the pantry, the scullery, the wine cellar, the root cellar, the laundry where in times past young girls, born into service, as the expression had it, had worn their hands raw with the washing. Ding paused in the semi-darkness and listened. A radio was on, which meant that her mother was in the kitchen, as Ding had suspected would be the case. She could smell the fragrance of cooking fruit as well. That was a very good thing, since such cooking would require her mother's close attention and thus keep her out of Ding's way. Then she heard her stepfather's voice. He, too, was in the kitchen, which Ding hadn't expected, talking either to her mum or into his mobile. The sound of him. And why was this? Why? Did what it always did to her. First were the shivers, then the fury started. She didn't understand why she had this reaction to Stephen, who had always treated her kindly, and she was sick to the bone of not understanding those things that surely she was meant to understand, if she was ever to put a full stop to how she'd been carrying on her life. And now she wanted an end to it, because the fact of Jack Corhanan had brought her up short. She'd never once done it with someone old enough to be her dad. It was the thought of her dad that took her to the steps at the far end of the corridor, those that would lead up to the traditional green baize door, with its baize so tattered at this point that it might have been nibbled upon by mice, and it probably had been, since, really, what could possibly be better than felt to line a mouse's nest? And God knew there were mice nests aplenty in Cardew Hall, along with birds' nests in the chimneys, and that's what she knew, of a sudden, just there, the nest of hair from which the penis emerged. But why was that important, and why could she barely cope with seeing it, and why did she force herself over and over to see it, to touch it, to take it into her mouth, if that's what he wanted, because wasn't that what he always wanted, and didn't they always want it, and didn't it come down to that in the end, the penis, and what was done with it, and because of it, and God, 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 what was wrong with her? Before she realized she was doing so, she was up the stairs and into the body of the house, and then up a second set of stairs, wide with panelled walls from which dim light from the landing window illuminated dusty paintings of nameless ancestors. Then she was in a shadowy corridor, panelled like the stairway walls, and she was standing in front of a broad door. It was locked, as it was always locked, because no one wanted to go inside, because no one, it seemed, wanted to remember, although what it was that no one wanted to remember she could not have said. But what she knew in this moment of shivering torso and quaking hands was that she had to get inside that room. She knew where the key was. It came to her that she'd always known, because in her mind's eye she was crouched in a corner in the shadows, and once the police had come and gone she had seen her mother lock that door, and put the key at the very top of a tree down so tall that she could barely reach it, and so, of course, Ding would never find it, only she'd seen from the shadows that that was where the key had gone to, and all along her mum had not shed a tear, not a single tear, and what was wrong with her? The tree down was still there. Nothing was ever moved in Cardew Hall, and nothing this large ever would be. But petite as she was,
Ding could not reach the top of it. She needed something to stand on, so she went to her mum and stepdad's room, and there she fetched one of those ancient stools, the kind with carvings and banged-up stretchers that people breathlessly took to the Antiques Roadshow, only to learn it was